Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we embrace the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. I have been interested in genealogy for decades. I remember burning the midnight oil, finding church records from England that had been digitized, writing notes trying to keep similar names and dates straight, wondering if Ashton and Ashton Underline were the same. Migration is part of the story for many of us, too. More recently, of course, we have DNA testing. It can get really complicated. Micah Anders is a highly regarded, very experienced genealogist, so I was really excited when she agreed to be my guest. Today, she talks about personal sleuthing and community sleuthing, and, of course, those skeletons in the closet, as well as the larger-than-life myths so many of us have. Are you curious? Listen now. I am so looking forward to this conversation today. It's a subject I've been interested in for decades. I have a couple of friends who've jumped in with great success, but they avoid me if I ask if they'll share their knowledge on podcast. That subject, genealogy. And perhaps it's just as well my friends avoided me as my guest today. Well, how's this for credentials? Micah has a Master of Fine Arts in Visual Art. She's a member of the Association of Professional Genealogists. She's the first ever history fellow at the Minnesota African American Heritage Museum. She received the 2023 Minnesota Genealogical Society's Pioneer Award. Do you say that really fast like you've said it so many
yes.
times? And she's worked with clients and organizations in the U.S., Canada, Jamaica, and the U.K., bringing underrepresented stories to light. I do believe she'll know her stuff. Micah Anders, welcome to the Boomer Woman's podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Inquiring minds need to know, I just reeled off a whole bunch of credentials for a young woman. What launched you down that road to take you this far, or so far already?
Yeah, so I love to consider myself young. I'm in my 40s, but still young by many standards. But I didn't start this path. As you mentioned, I have a Master's of Fine Arts in Visual Arts, which is very different than genealogy. But actually, while I was doing my master's thesis work, I was doing genealogy projects and turning them into art projects. So they've always really sort of lived in a space together for me. You know, most people start out doing their own genealogy, learning their own history. And I really loved learning other people's, their family stories, solving their family mysteries, reintroducing them to their ancestors. It was just amazing to be able to do that and to give people back their family stories. So that's how I really started on the helping other people side. I'd done my own. Actually, when I was growing up, my grandpa wrote a book and my mom was the editor. So I spent hours when I was little. This is way before computer programs. So, you know, she's cutting and pasting blocks of text and taping them with special tape to make the books and all of the different things. And so just being around family stories was just part of what I always had been around. So it just came naturally to me in that sense. And I also just love a good mystery. Agatha Christie, Miss Marple, or even Nancy Drew has always been something I've been drawn to. So it's been fun to mix all that together.
Well, that's good, because a few of my questions are going to be around the mysteries that you solve or uncover, shall we say. Now, you have African American heritage. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between researching that history, as we all know, many African North Americans were brought to this, you know, they were ripped from their family, their land, brought to this land as slaves, as opposed to most of us white people whose forebears came to North America for adventure or to conquer, maybe for love, perhaps to avoid the law in their country of origin. Can you explain sort of how you go about what you do?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the difference, shall we say?
So I get to have both of them in me. So I have one white parent and one black parent. So I've had both journeys right in my own family tree.
Okay,
so
perfect.
So on my mom's side, we go back to Germany and we go back to the Bohemian region of the Czech area and Switzerland. So that's sort of that side of me. So I have a lot of those stories as well. And then on my dad's side, it's very more common, that story of enslavement. I can trace to Missouri in the United States and stay in that state for generations and generations, and they were enslaved in that state. Eventually, I can get to the East Coast, but I haven't been able to get back to another country besides the United States. Part of that is, to be honest, because they've been in the United States for so many generations. You know, we're going back to a time that obviously there aren't as many paper records for anybody, let alone people who at the time were considered property. So, you know, I think a lot of times when we do African-American research, people want to have that same experience of what was my country of origin? But often that's because a lot of the folks that have those stories, like on my mom's side, it is actually a much more recent history. You know, I know which relatives came across from Europe. It wasn't that long ago. I know that my grandpa only spoke German until his third or fourth time in kindergarten because they thought he was stupid because he couldn't speak English, right? Even though he became a chemistry professor, so he was not stupid. But a lot of those differences come down to what kind of records exist, if those records were kept and are still accessible, and just understanding that at some point, African American genealogy, your records of your family are property records, not personal records.
If I'm only just showing off my ignorance here, but if you were able to track back to an African nation, like if I go back to England, there's like church records for centuries because that was the nature of that society. Does anything like that even exist in many African cultures?
So some could, but most of it would have been oral traditions. Mm-hmm. So it would have been a lot of different places had what was called a griot, G-R-I-O-T, a griot. And that was the storyteller. And that was the keeper of the stories, the keeper of the history. And then as they became an elder, it was their job to train in the next griot to keep those stories alive. And a lot of times in genealogy, we forget that not everybody had a paper tradition. So that's not even just African American. That's the case in some Native American cultures. That's the case in some Asian American or Asian in general cultures, is they have, some have amazing paper records and scrolls that go back to times before I can even imagine. And other people may have been more nomadic. You know, they moved around a lot. So their traditions were kept in things like story quilts. They put their stories in embroidery. And that's how they told their family histories and their town histories and things like that.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about the storyteller, because my mom was directly from England. And I went back just enough times as a young woman to meet a bunch of the people, to hear the stories, because I was back there summer after summer after summer. And it occurred to me that a lot of those stories, they'll die with me. And I've actually got a page on one of my websites that's called Stories My Mother Told Me. So it's, you know, obviously that takes time, but just some of the stories that they'll be gone because I'm one of the last people to know those connections.
Exactly. So. And that happens so often. I've actually had a couple clients recently where it's usually a mother and their child. One's a mother and a daughter. One's a mother and a son. The mothers are both in their 80s, I would say. So it's kind of a team project for them to really pass the history forward with my assistance. In both cases, I shared family information. In one family, I was saying, did you know your family last name has changed like four different times? And the mom said, yeah. And the son said, Mom, you never told me. He's in his 60s, right? Mom. How do I not know this in my 60s? You never shared that. And it's that simple. It's just gone. You know, in the other case, it was grandma had been married twice. And the daughter thought that grandma's husband, who she thought was grandpa, was the only husband she'd ever had. And it turns out he was actually the second husband and wasn't even her direct bloodline. So were she to do her genealogy, she would be going up the whole wrong line, but would have no way of knowing because, well, that's the man who's always been my grandpa my whole life. Right. And just that one generation, those stories are gone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy when you think about the, I don't know, repercussions, perhaps, for lack of a better, you know,
yeah,
contacting these long-lost relatives who are going like, what are you talking about?
Absolutely.
Now, I did some research about 30 years ago. There was, even at that point in time, there was quite a bit online, Most of it seemed to be through the Mormon Church, unless, as I just said, a few of those churches in England had digitized their records. How do you go about that now? And I understand now you can do the DNA testing as well.
Mm-hmm. So I think the important thing is so much is online, but big, however, okay. Because so much is online, people don't do some of the work that we used to do, right? When everything wasn't online, we were writing letters to historical societies in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. We were sending out letters to distant cousins, you know, these things that actually were like the legwork part. A lot of people don't do that work anymore because so much is online, but so much still isn't and never will be. You know, I think about here in the U.S., the National Archives. There's no way everything at the National Archives could ever possibly be digitized. There's not even any way to store that. There's no server that could store all of that. And there's not enough volunteers anywhere to do all of that work. So, yes, so much more is digitized. And it's amazing. We can get so many birth certificates. Here in Minnesota, where I live, they still don't have the death certificates digitized. You have to go to the Historical Society and you have to go find them on microfilm to this day. So simple things like that, we just don't even think about, okay, well, I should probably get that death certificate. It might tell me who somebody's real parents were, or maybe not, right? You just never know. But the other thing is with DNA, I could talk about DNA forever. With DNA, you learn new things that maybe you didn't know you didn't know. But it does take you places that sometimes there's not a paper trail for.
Okay, I wasn't sure if you're going to keep going, because in my notes, the very next thing I was going to ask you is, I've seen those shows where people are patriotically from one background and can be really derisive about another culture.
They
get their DNA tested and they find out that they have DNA from that culture that they thought was like their enemy. Has that ever happened in any of your searches?
So I haven't had anybody get too caught up, but I have had people find siblings they didn't know about. Oh. I've had people find out that one of their parents isn't their parent. I've had people find out that one of their grandparents isn't one of their grandparents. I've had a lot of those things happen. Even in my family, we found out that my grandma's dad was not the man we thought it was because there was an extramarital affair. And it is what it is at this point, right? We're however many generations since then. DNA is how we found that out. No paper trail would ever have told us that because all the papers lined up with the marriage. And part of how we found out was through DNA matches. But the other thing is, on my mom's side, the man who's supposed to be my grandma's dad is German. So when my mom DNA tests, she should be 3/4 German, 1/4 Swiss. Well, no. She was about half German, 1/4 Swiss, and the rest was all weird. And it's because this is the line that was Czech. So all of the history of migration through the Bohemian region and everybody that's come from that, that's that other part of her DNA. So if she had just been so sure of her German heritage, her Germanic heritage, and just known that that was it, just German and Swiss, she would have been very wrong as soon as she got that DNA test. And it's funny because, like, we're pretty connected to our German culture because, like I said, my grandpa only spoke German for so long. And by the time my mom came around, he refused to teach anybody because it was basically beaten out of him. But we still ate German food. It was still part of our culture in different ways. Certain little expressions he would say when he was mad. And so we're tied to that. But all of a sudden, we're also Czech, which is so weird because we have no personal feelings or affiliation with that because it's not a culture we grew up with, even though technically my grandma was 50% Czech and she just didn't even know it.
I'm going to ask you a question of here, and I don't think any of my siblings listen to this podcast. It's something that I have considered. Is my dad was in Italy during the war. You hear about all sorts of goings on when people are at war. If I were to have my DNA tested, is there any way to find out if I match the DNA partially of someone in Italy? I guess they would have had to have their DNA tested too, is that right?
Correct. So there's two pieces. One is they also would have had to have tested. The other thing is you need to both have tested in the same database. So if they tested in Italy, it's possible they would have used a company like MyHeritage, which is more Europeans have tested on MyHeritage and you tested, say, on Ancestry or 23andMe or something like that. You may never know. So you have to have both tested and be in the same database. I have my DNA in all the databases. So if anybody were to pop up, I would find them. But I do have things like that happen with some of my clients. I had a woman message me because I manage one of my clients' DNA. She's not as computer savvy. So she just said, "I just let me know. Tell me what you find. I don't know how to use this computer." She's in her late 70s and she just said, it's not for me. But she had somebody message her slash me on her behalf who was half Vietnamese and was trying to find her American father's family lineage. And she wasn't a close enough relative to my client for me to easily say, oh, yeah, I can tell you exactly who it is. She was like a third of cousin once removed or something. So it's somewhat distant. So it's going to be a lot of work to figure out who that person was. But I definitely have seen that. And I saw somebody who's half Vietnamese, half American, somebody who was half Korean, half American as well. So yeah, it's absolutely possible. And all of those cases are cases where that person was also curious. So it takes them wanting to find out and being okay with whatever they find because it's kind of scary to put yourself out there in the world and say, well, I don't know who I'll find. I don't know if they'll accept me. I don't know if I'm going to ruin their family story with my existence. It can get really, really sensitive.
So you say your DNA, for example, is on all of the platforms. For someone like me, whose mother is directly from England, my paternal grandparents were directly from England and Germany. It would be worth my while, or maybe that's the most logical place to have my DNA tested then.
Yeah, I would say so. What's nice about MyHeritage is if you have DNA tested with 23andMe or Ancestry, I personally at this point would recommend Ancestry over 23andMe. I get nothing for that, but they have a bigger matching pool and more people have trees that you can look at and try and figure out how you relate to each other. So with that, on both of those two sites, you can do what's called download your raw DNA. Which does nothing for most of us. It's just, a bunch of code. But then you can upload that to MyHeritage. You can upload that to FamilyTree DNA and another one called GEDmatch, which some people like, some people say stay away from because law enforcement is allowed to use GEDmatch. And so people have their own personal feelings on that. There's no right or wrong. But you would then be able to put your DNA onto MyHeritage for a smaller fee than having to test again, which costs way more.
Okay. Now, you mentioned finding out things that were surprises. You've got these paper records, but I take it you can start digging. Once you have names and places and dates, you can start digging into more of the story. Are there very many skeletons in the closet?
I think everybody's got them. That's what I have learned. Everybody comes to me, not everybody. I have clients who come to me, and when we first get on that first meeting call, you can see they just feel a little bit of shame or a little like, well, there's this thing that happened in my family. And as soon as they share the thing, honestly, it's something I've heard so many times that I say, oh, that's okay. I've dealt with that like seven other times. And you can almost feel the relief settle in because we all have so much shame about this thing that happened in the past. And I think a couple things. One, oftentimes the shame we're carrying is from another generation and it's become our shame. And I think it's really important. Like I can talk about what happened to my grandma without attaching myself to it. I can empathize. I can feel like, man, there's a lot of things there, but I don't need to own it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so when people have those family stories and those skeletons in the closet, I think understanding, one, the things that people hid generations in the past, for example, say somebody got pregnant at 15 and they didn't have a husband. That level of shame was so big in certain time periods and in certain cultures. Now, there's still a stigma with a young pregnancy, but we're not going to necessarily hide the woman or the teen and, you know, make the baby her sister and her mother raises it, or sort of those things that happened more than they do now. So I think, you know, just realizing that the human condition at the end of the day, there's only so many ways the secret can have been a secret. There's only so many skeletons, and most likely somebody else has had something similar that we've had to work through or accidentally found along the way. I've got all kinds of accidental found skeletons. Yeah.
Okay. Now, how about the family myths? Can you prove and disprove those through your research?
Oftentimes I can. So it depends what the myth is and if there's enough data that we can put behind it. So if there's a family myth that I had a client, the family myth was that grandma died on a Harley and nobody could prove it on a motorcycle. Nobody could prove it. It's kind of like, why are we thinking, what was grandma like that this is the story we're telling about her? So, okay, well, let's go to the newspapers. Was it big enough that it made it into a newspaper? Did she die in a car accident? Did she get hit by a Harley? Was she riding it? Was there something in her death certificate that says cause of death, motorcycle accident? So things like that are ways we can try and take those family myths and see if they really happened. Oftentimes, like a good game of telephone, every generation has passed that story forward and it's morphed. Right. Sometimes if it's a good story, it gets bigger and bigger. I have some research I did where a client, the obituary says that this person served in the Civil War, that they started out fighting for the South. They lay in a pile of bodies, covered themselves in blood, escaped, switched sides. Like, there's a whole story in this obituary. Okay. So I went through all of the records for every single person with this name. There's no record showing he ever even served. There's nothing. So then the question is, so where did this story even come from that all of a sudden he was a soldier? Well, it looks like, from what I can tell, he was somebody who walked alongside. A lot of them had, you know, people who just wanted to get out of their circumstances, and they walked alongside and helped out. They were cooks. They were teamsters. They worked with the animals. And it looks like that's what he did. But the story has morphed over all these generations to him being almost like a hero in two different sides of the Civil War. But through the records and through taking the story and not discounting it, but just understanding that there's data there, but maybe not really true truth, we can find the truth.
I am positive that it is a true fact that I am descended from Spanish royalty. I just want to say that right out.
Everybody's descended from royalty at this point. Everybody. Yeah, that's my favorite one, is everybody has descended from a king or a queen. I don't think everybody can't have descended from the kings and queens. That'd be even more interrelated.
I was going to say, yeah. I'm glad I'm one of the ones that did that. No, I'm just, there's way more to that story, but I'm not going to get into it. Now, how about in the case of adoption and then more recently, sperm donation? Is that a little hornet's nest?
Oh, sperm donation is a huge hornet's nest right now. Adoption, I would say, similar to what I was talking about with the people who are looking for their American parents who may have been born to an American soldier as one of their parents, usually the father. with adoption, so many great things have happened. I know people who have found their birth parents, they've reconnected, they become part of the family. I know people who, on the flip side, I know a man who took a DNA test because his wife's into genealogy, so I know the wife, and he found out when he was in high school he fathered a child, and the girl never told him. Gave the child up for adoption and never even told him. He said, well, what if I wanted to be in that child's life? What if I, as a high schooler, was prepared, you know, hindsight, whatever it is? So it can open some really big wounds for people. But at the end of the day, I would say more good than anything has come from people who are adopted choosing to DNA test, because it gives you answers. It can give you pictures of people who look like you for the first time ever. Even if you don't necessarily connect with your parents, maybe they've passed, maybe there's another trauma that's keeping that connection from forming. Oftentimes, though, maybe a sibling, maybe a half-sibling, even maybe cousins, aunties, something, someone that you form that connection with, and you're able to just have this piece of you. I think the other thing that happens is often the adopted parents, there's a moment where often adopted parents feel if they find their birth parents, they won't want me anymore, as opposed to, you know, remembering that love can only grow, that there's room in your heart for both, and they're different. So it's not a replacement. It's this person holds a different place in my heart than the place the people who raised me hold. So that's the adoption side. The sperm donation side is very, very messy, because a few things. One, and this is all just my opinion, so we're going to put a big old caveat on that. This is Micah's thoughts. One, I do know there are people who chose sperm donation who have gotten their children tested as children. 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, they're DNA testing them to figure out who the dad is. To me, if you made the choice to use an anonymous donor, then it doesn't make sense to then do the work to figure out who that anonymous donor was. That's one. Two, oftentimes those donors may have donated years ago. Quite frequently, they are college students who need a little extra money. And all of a sudden, however long the cryobank has kept those samples for use for women who are trying to conceive or families who are trying to conceive, they may not be prepared to find out they have 10 or 12 children, you know? And then there's this sort of really weird quandary of, this is my child, this is not my child, right? Because it's biologically your child. So it's very, very messy. And I think there's just not enough protections in place for the originally given anonymity of the donors. But at the same time, similar to adoption, those kids are going to grow up and want to find who else looks like me. Who are my siblings? And some beautiful communities have started with the siblings themselves. So I think from that perspective, it can be amazing because you have this amazing sibling set. Now they're your siblings, but you weren't raised together, but biologically you're clearly half siblings. So that's why I say it's messy. There's a lot of pieces. And I think the last piece of that is I personally wouldn't suggest DNA testing a child. I feel like they should be at an age where they're consenting to their information being in the system like that. I don't necessarily know if you need to wait till 18, but I would say definitely to an age where you can have some pretty informed conversations, because there's a lot of consent you have to give in order to DNA test. And they actually can't give that consent as a child.
Okay. I'm going to ask you another question, which may be totally out of your bailiwick because it is based on a recent other interview. So say somebody either adopted or from a sperm donation does their DNA testing. They find their biological parent who has just passed away. Do they have any claim on that estate? Say you found out that, mm-hmm. you know, that teenage boy is now a multi-billionaire. Mm-hmm. Is there any claim or not?
That's a really good question. No, I've heard ponderings of this before, and I don't know. It seems as though you sign so many things when you, the other parent, signs up to do assisted conception. I don't know what else we would call that, right? That I don't know if they have a claim, but that's also not their fault, right? It's like this weird thing. It's like, it's not my fault that my mom or dad signed these things and therefore I don't have rights to this other family. But it also becomes very problematic for the family themselves. Say the multimillionaire passes, everything's divvied up amongst the family that they raised, and all of a sudden somebody's swooping in and saying, well, my genetics are tied to this person, so I get a piece. It's kind of messy. So no, it's very messy. And it's like uncharted territory right now. And there doesn't seem to be any, there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in really defining some of that stuff because it is also an industry. Yeah,
what a
complicated,
messy world, eh? Yeah. Okay, so a client comes to you. I'm going to use this word carefully. Can you tell us about a typical, I'm using air quotes, search you might do? Like, where do you start?
So oftentimes, I have a couple different client types. One client type comes to me because they've already DNA tested and they got one of those mysteries. Either they DNA tested and they're not understanding who any of these matches are, none of the last names match what they thought they should find, or the ethnicity is all wrong, or they found a sibling, or they got a weird contact from somebody. So that's one client type. I handle that one way. The other client type is people who either have a specific person in mind, maybe Aunt Sue was a big mystery, they want to figure out what her life was all about. Or maybe they just want to know, you know, their family legacy and the generations that came before them. For those clients, I start out with the census. Always, always the census records. In the U.S., they came out every 10 years. Obviously, Canada had the Canadian census as well. Other countries also did census records to an extent. The census gives us a snapshot of a day every 10 years here in the U.S. If you're lucky, get a state census. Sometimes those are on the fives. But those census records tell us who lived in the house, where they lived. Sometimes you get information, did they own their property? Did they rent? What kind of jobs people had? And on most census records during a certain time window, 1850 to 1950, really, that's what's out right now, it's up till 1950 in the U.S., you'll get where they were from, and on many of them, where their mom was from and where their dad was from. So just that little snapshot gives you so much data to start mining, like the clues, like I was talking about with my Nancy Drew, right? So it gives you a place to start. Okay, what matches the narrative I've been told? What doesn't match the narrative I've been told? And I always say, don't just look at one census, find all of them. So one might say that your family member was born in one place, and then 10 years earlier, it says they were born somewhere else. Well, obviously, they were only born in one place. Now you have some conflicting evidence that you have to resolve and solve those puzzles. After the census, you look for birth certificates, death certificates. I think the thing people forget is to get those birth and death certificates and also to look in the newspapers. The newspapers were gold. I like to think of them as the Facebook of their time. Especially as we go back to certain time windows, it'll say things like, Sue Johnson went visiting to the next town over to see her good friend Jane, or it'll say to go see her niece and her sister, and it'll name them. And all of a sudden that newspaper gave you her name, her sister's daughter, and where they live. So, okay, now I know where they live. Now I can find the records for them and kind of build out this family story depending on what goals I have.
Okay. And if it's relatively straightforward, how long does it take you to build out a fairly detailed story for a client, or is that just too random?
I can give a sort of answer. So, okay. Again, it depends what they're looking for. If they're just looking for something on one family member who you know, died on a Harley, and that's really their mission, is tell us who this person was. Or I have cases where somebody will say, I know my grandpa, but I have nothing further than that. I don't know who his parents were. I don't know who his siblings were. I know nothing else about him. If really the goal is to learn about this person, then that usually takes about 6 weeks. So from start to finish, finding the information, finding the story. So, because my thing is, I can give you names and dates, but like that doesn't feel like you've met the person. It doesn't make it feel like they have anything to do with you. You want to know their stories, right? You want to know who they were, what life experiences they had, why they moved, who else lived in their house, where they lived, things like that. Usually you can do that in about 6 weeks. When you're trying to build out mom's line, dad's line, all your grandparents, great and maybe great greats, or even further back, that can take a lot longer if you want the stories. Some people say, I just want names and dates. I just want to know who was whom, where they lived, and who was in what country or what part of the states or whatever. That doesn't take as long, but the stories are what take the most time.
Now, I read in your profile that you use art and visual storytelling. How does that come into the picture?
So a few different ways. One thing I do is I work with historical societies a lot to make exhibits. So they'll hire me, and I have a team of research assistants to come in and research usually a hidden history, sometimes early African Americans. Recently, we've been finding a lot of early Chinese laundry services in the 1860s, 1870s, in a lot of really rural areas. So come in, do the research, learn about who they were as people, learn maybe what their community response was to them being there, and then take that, and instead of just writing a book, which is fine, books are great, I love to read, as you can see, turning it into something visual that can bring people in so they can really learn that history and keep it alive. Keeping it out, keeping it on display keeps it alive. I also make family trees for clients. I just gave my mom a new design that I made, and it's five generations. So it's my daughter, me, my mom, her mom, and then my mom's grandma, my great-grandma, all lined up with portraits of all of us, and then has some cute quotes or something. But then it's something that goes on the wall, as opposed to a chart that's really sort of technical looking, that just gets put in a binder or gets folded up somewhere. So I really want the histories to stay alive, keep them active, keep them in part of the conversation you have at home. When it's up on the wall, it stays a conversation piece.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I can only imagine what some of that looks like. Now, when you mentioned communities, because you also research the backgrounds of communities, how do you go about that? And then also, I guess one of my questions was, do you go back to, okay, like these three families came together and that was the beginning of it and it grew from there? Is that where you sort of stop, or do you figure out then where those three families came from and what caused them to come together and create this other community?
Both. So okay. With that work, often it's up to the historical societies what they want, and then sometimes we'll push them a little bit to go a little deeper than their original thought process. But oftentimes, like you just shared, we'll say, okay, we know these families came in whatever year and they started this little community. But why? The first question I always have is, how did they even find this random place? Because they're the most random places that people start communities, right? Was this the last stop on the train? Well, there probably wasn't even a train yet. So like, how did they just decide this random piece of land? There's often not a river, there's nothing there.
That's where the wagon wheel broke.
Right, exactly. So that's what we try to figure out, is why here? What made somebody come to this spot? We also research who was here, when they came already, who got displaced by them coming here. And that part, that's called anti-racist genealogy, is kind of the term for that. And keeping that in mind, really make sure you're painting a full story of that place and those people. The because the idea that people came to empty space is not always an accurate story, or that there was just free land available for the taking is not always an accurate story. So we make sure to frame it in what was really happening, and not sort of this narrative that transformed with that telephone story into the future. Often we'll trace, okay, well, how long did they stay? Did they stay and then they're the families that were there for generations? Or did they come? They started this place, they left, they started another place, because then all of a sudden we have land prospectors, and that's a very different thing than community starters. It's like a different mindset, right? So we do a little bit of both.
How does the town respond when you bring together, like, especially if it's really complicated or really diverse or something? I don't know.
Yeah. So usually if the first response is, oh, wow, I never knew, I wish I'd known. So often it's a place of gratitude, like, thank you for giving me this information. Thank you for uncovering these stories of our town and this place. A lot of times people say, wow, I thought my family had been here a long time, but we were really like the fourth wave of people to come here. So it helps people understand better how their own family narratives fit into that place. And it also helps them understand what that place really was. You know, if you find out, oh, there were all these African-American families and there were Chinese laundries and there were Native people still living here, and then people were coming from Sweden and people were coming from Germany, and oh, they all actually lived here at the same time. Nobody ever told me that. You know, it changes how you perceive what is a pioneer and what does an early settler look like.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure there's times when, you know, somebody who's got an overinflated view of their own self-importance and heritage, you know, that they were, their family was one of the founding families, and then to find out, well, actually, no, they were the fourth generation after the town was, you know, it's like,
yeah,
a little
yeah,
bit of comeuppance there. Yeah.
They usually kind of harumph and don't stay very long at the openings of things, you know, or like, oh, well, this is just one version. Okay, well, that's fine. We'll call it one version. I've got lots of sources that I can cite for you,
yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's not necessary. If that version of history is so important to them, it's not my place to do anything.
Oh,
you know, I can just bring my sources and I can cite everything, and people will do with it as they do with it.
Yeah, yeah. Can we ask for a few trade secrets? I'm just thinking, if somebody in the audience is wanting to just get started by themselves, at least. Now, I know you have a free download. It's called 7 Often Overlooked Research Gold Mines. Can you tease us with just one or two?
Church records is the first. I don't know if it's first on the list, but that's the first tease I have for you, is church records. People don't look at them. Church records have so much information. I went back to our family church in Michigan, and the books are all still sitting there when people signed for baptisms, marriages, funerals. All those records are just sitting in a lot of churches. Again, when you go back to England, there's a lot of them still in places that obviously didn't have any war bombings or anything like that. But those church records aren't just even those log books. Depending on when your ancestors lived there, there could be meeting minutes. You might find out they were part of the women's auxiliary of the such and such, you know, ministerial alliance. And just learning those things, again, they help tell the story. Like, oh, well, I knew she was at church a lot. You know, the family, like, being religious has been passed down, but now I understand that, oh, this was like really a part of who we were, was part of this. Or you find out not only were at the church, well, they also, you know, volunteered at the Catholic school next door or things like that. And a lot of that's just sitting in those records. And we don't even think to look at them because, again, they're not online. You have to make a phone call, or you have to drive there, or you have to hire somebody in that place to go to that church, if that church even still exists. Sometimes in the case of the Catholic Church, if those get closed down, sometimes the archdiocese will take over their records and they'll be housed off-site somewhere. Speaking of schools, the other one is school records. Often overlooked. Yearbooks. So many of us don't have pictures of our relatives. If we are so lucky, they will either have a yearbook, or early on they didn't have a yearbook, they had just like one photo, the headshots of everybody in the class, or or it's just all the kids sitting together in a row and somebody's holding the chalkboard that says 1906 or something like that. Those might be pictures we've never seen. Nobody may have ever seen them because the family never had them. They're at the school. Or you can find things like grades. Those can be fun sometimes to find out what kind of students your family members were. Or you can find out what club they were in. I found out my grandma from her yearbook was in the archery club. Well, that's really cool. Does that give me anything like important about her? Not necessarily, but that kind of changes how I think about her. I knew she was really smart. I knew she was in the math. You know, she did a lot of math, but archery, I didn't even know girls had an archery club at her school in Omaha, Nebraska. But things like that, you know, people are in the glee club. Oh, that's why singing has been so important for generations in my family. Things like that. I think so. School records and church records, very underutilized, full of amazing things if you can find them.
It's interesting you mentioned church records because my grandmother had a whole bunch of church record kind of things. So, you know, this was the women's auxiliary in this year, or I don't know, different things. And because they basically meant nothing to me, I mean, we're going back to the early 1900s, I contacted that church and I said, I've got all this stuff. Are you interested? I'm happy to pay the postage. And I just got a really short note back saying, no, we've got enough. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, so frustrating.
Yeah, and I guess and it feels funny destroying history to me. Anyways, it feels funny to me to destroy history. But
It happens all the time. It happens all the time. There's now newspapers that don't have a full run because somebody was storing them in the basement of their house. Because it was a smaller newspaper. Maybe it was an ethnic newspaper. Maybe it was a local German or the local African-American newspaper. So it was not a big building. It was stored in somebody's home. For generations, their grandkids are like, oh my gosh, grandma's just hoarding all these newspapers without realizing she has like the original copies of something that when they're gone forever. There's no replacing them. It's hard. That stuff is hard. But at the same time, I mean, there is a point where we can't keep it all. So it's this really weird fine balance. So I know for me, whenever I'm in like a newspaper article or I'm in some of these books or whatever, I put a flag in them. You know, I take my post-it notes and I put a little thing that writes, you know, this is me or whatever. So if somebody were to go through my book collection and say, okay, you know, it's time, my passing has come. At least the books that I'm in, somebody will see that note and say, okay, why is that page marked? Hopefully they would at least look because there's not too many of them. Say, oh, this is important. And they would keep it. But we don't think about that stuff. You know, we know all the stuff we have. We know what's important and what's not. I actually do work with some social clubs and women's organizations to help them with their archiving. Because again, most of it's in somebody's basement. They may have been around for 50, 60 years, but they're a social club. They don't have a building anywhere. And so we talk about the need to get specific tubs. They need to be waterproof. They need to be everything proof. You need to label them. It needs to be in giant letters on the top. This is the archive for the such and such women's club. If something happens to me, here's who you pass it on to. And I'm working with those organizations and it feels morbid, but it's real. It's real to just, it's the same as having a will. It's your succession plan for these things. You're the current keeper of them, but technically they're not yours. You're just the keeper.
Yeah, it's interesting you say waterproof tubs because I was one of those people that kept random things for posterity. I don't know why. And one of the houses I lived in about 15 years ago, I had what was basically my memorabilia trunk, right? And it was even up off the ground. It was everything, but it took on water and I didn't know that. So when I was moving, of course, I opened it up thinking, oh, I should really go through this. And as soon as I opened it, it was like one smell and I went like, oh my God, like all of this has to go. It just, because it was just that old mildewy smell that you never get that smell out.
No, you can't get it out. And if you're lucky, you can scan some of them, but historical societies won't touch it. They won't scan it for you because as soon as one of those spores gets even in their space, it's just done. So you have to figure out how do I can't scan it. I can do almost nothing. Some people have figured out how to try and photograph it. But yeah, it gets so frustrating.
Oh, well, that was then. Now, one term you use caught my eye because I do it too before chatting with guests. Explain Facebook stalking and why.
Facebook stalking. So,
just for the record, I didn't find anything usable on you.
That's okay. That's okay. Because I do it, it means I know how to.
Yeah, right.
Once you start doing it, it definitely changes what you put out in the world. I can tell you that. So imagine you have a DNA match. It's a close DNA match. First cousin range, aunt, uncle, something, right? And you don't know who they are. You've never seen them before. If you're lucky, they have a picture, because you can also do reverse Google image searches on people. But first thing I do is I put that name in Facebook. I start with Google, or whatever search engine you feel like using. And I just put their name in there, hoping it's not John Smith or something that's too common. And I see what comes up. Maybe it's a LinkedIn page. Maybe it's some obscure SoundCloud dot whatever. But then you find them on Facebook. And once you find somebody on Facebook, depending on what they do, you can almost put together like a third of their family tree. So what you'll notice happens is somebody posts a picture of Miss my mom. Normal, right? On mom's birthday. Oh, mom's birthday. Okay, well, now I know what your mom's birthday is, which is great, because maybe that'll help me figure out how you're related to me, right? So, okay, mom's birthday. Okay, now we also know, if we're lucky, we have mom's name. Sometimes it just says mom's birthday. So where do we go? The comment section. Somebody's going to write, oh, Aunt Maxine, we miss you. Okay, so Maxine was born on this date. We now have her first name and we have her birthday. If we're lucky, we can go through, okay, well, if it's your aunt, that means that you and this person might be first cousins, which means you may have some data that's helpful to me. Well, let me go to your Facebook page and see what I can find. So now I go to your Facebook page and it's way more open than the original person's. I can see your whole friends list. Oh, I can see your friends list. Okay. Let's start typing in some last names that make sense with how we might be related. Oh, you have some of the same last names that are in my tree as well. Okay, from there, do I know any of these people? In one case, I was working with a client and I did some Facebook stalking on one of their DNA matches. This was somebody who didn't know who her dad was. And so she was in her, she was 84, and she said, you know what? Before I'm done here in this earth, I want answers. I want to know who my dad was once and for all. Can you help me? And we figured it out using her DNA. And part of it was, and this is a crazy story, one of her top DNA matches, I found them on Facebook. Again, and I didn't contact her. I literally just was on her page. And she had three friends that were friends of mine. And so nobody was related to me. The first thing I said is, oh, well, I'm not going to reach out to her because I don't know her, but I sure will reach out to my friends. So I reached out to one of my friends. And I said, hey, they know I'm a genealogist, so they already know that I'm going to ask weird questions. Hey, I see your friends with so-and-so. How well do you know them? Because it's Facebook. It could just be, you know, something super random. And he said, oh, that's my aunt. I said, is it? Interesting. I said, so I can't tell them about my client because, right, confidentiality. So I just kind of have to say, they said, why are you looking at their page? I said, one of my clients intersects with them with their DNA. Kind of all I can say. So I'm just trying to figure out more to see how that person and my client might be related. So they're able to tell me, oh, well, her dad's name was this, her mom's name was this. And eventually I was able to use that data, plus obviously regular genealogical research, to figure out who my client's dad was. It was through Facebook. That was that without that Facebook, I probably still would have been able to figure it out, but oh my gosh, it would have been so much more complicated. Yeah. Facebook.
Yeah, and Yeah, and I do the same sort of thing with the English part of my family, just to try to keep people straight. Because, you know, I mean, I know my generation, but I don't know the next generation down, or now the even younger generation, you know. So it's just sort of curious to, you know, like, oh my goodness, they had like 6 kids, seriously? You know,
yeah.
In this day and age, it's sort of different. But
yeah, people don't have 6. I have 1. Yeah. The other thing that's really great, though, about Facebook, while we're talking about it, for all the things going on with Meta, we won't get into that right now. There's a lot of things. But I created a Facebook group with my last name. Well, not my last name, but my family last name, and then The Next Generation. It's just a private group. My aunts and uncles are in it. Those are on Facebook. My cousins are in it. My cousins' kids are in it. Some of them aren't even really on Facebook, but they're just in this group. So sometimes when I don't want to share something on all of Facebook, say somebody comes to town, my aunt comes to town, and my aunt and my mom and my daughter and I go out to dinner. Well, I'll post that in there and just say, you know, fun times with family, or Merry Christmas, family. And maybe I'll post a picture. My mom has all the pictures. She was in charge of the photo archive for the family, and she's done all this work digitizing it. I'll pull an old Christmas picture from when my mom and her siblings were kids, and I'll throw it in that private group. And I'll just, you know, post that. And what's great is for most of my cousins, who are, at this point, we range from 30s to late 50s, maybe early 60s, I would say. Probably 50s, 30s to 50s. A lot of them have never seen these pictures of their parents and their aunts and uncles. And what's great is they're seeing this picture for the first time, and what will happen is my aunts and uncles or their spouses, who are also in the group, will comment, "I remember that. This is a memory I have." And all of a sudden, to your point about those family stories, they're now digitized. They're written down. And I did it in a really organic way. It's not like, here's the prompt that you need to respond to, because that can create anxiety and pressure for people, right? Like, oh gosh, I got to say the right thing. But when it's a simple just, oh yeah, I remember that day. Oh my gosh, I forgot about that shirt I was wearing. I remember when I bought that shirt, or, you know, silly stuff like that. But that's a way to use Facebook to keep your family kind of connected. And then it is a way that, even if you're not even sure, you know, people are having kids, you're like, oh, we're 3 generations down. If they're in the group, you can click on it and you can still go to their regular Facebook and maybe see what else they got going on.
It's sort of interesting because I'm on Facebook. I've just admitted that. I have 3 children. One of my daughters is on Facebook occasionally. My other 2 kids aren't on Facebook. So here I'm starting this Facebook page, and it's like, yeah, but what about your kids? Oh, yeah, well, you don't need to know about them.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, what are people going to use to stay in touch? Because now we're on like 7 different platforms, and people don't talk on the phone. People don't write letters. Families don't usually send out an email with a big old, like, reply all. So a lot of people are becoming really disconnected from their families because we don't have those same touch points we used to have to say. Christmas cards don't happen like they used to. I don't get nearly as many, here's a picture of all the things we did in the past year, you know, or here's us looking matching in our cute outfits or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, our audience is primarily mid-age women. Now you know why I called you young. What haven't I asked you that you want them to think about if they're ancestor curious? Is there something you haven't touched on?
Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. 2 things. The first is, even if you're not ancestor curious, you are going to become an ancestor. So it is the responsibility, I believe, of all of us to write some of those stories down. If it's just on taking your camera and talking to it every so often and sending it to an email address or a Google Drive, I don't know, whatever you want to do. We forget that somebody's going to be looking for us someday. And if we can give them anything to start with, they've got a head start, especially as things are becoming more digital. It's actually becoming much more difficult to do genealogy going forward in time. We don't have as many paper records. So anything we can do to leave a trail for our descendants in the future to find us is very, very important. So that's thing one. Thing two is, if you are curious and you're thinking, maybe I want to start this journey, start now. Just start. Start with writing up what you know. okay, whose names do I know? Do I know both my parents' names? Do I know all four of my grandparents' names? See where your holes are. And then that'll give you a good sense of, I should probably start here. Or if you are so lucky to have anybody in the generation above you still living, some people have that, some people don't, talk to them like yesterday. Because we never know how long they're still going to be around to have those conversations with. Again, even if you're not sure you're going to care, oftentimes people, because I'm pretty young for my field. Again, in my 40s, I started this in my early 30s, late, no, I started in my late 20s doing this work, probably about 25. Really, I don't know, mid, whatever that is. I was about 25. So I was very young at that time. But most of the people doing this work, even when you go to conferences, they're in their 60s and 70s. And they're just getting started. And they always say, I wish I'd started sooner. I didn't care before. I wish I'd cared. I hear it over and over and over and over again. So just kind of food for thought that if it's not something you're thinking about now, for many people, it becomes something you think about. And then you often wish you'd thought about it earlier.
Yeah, well, and especially as you say, if digital records are, you know, and paper records, especially, they're just going to be non-existent soon.
Yeah. So. Oh, and one other thing. If you have small people in your life, make sure they learn cursive. Our records are in cursive and they're not teaching it at school.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
So just teach them cursive, even just for fun, just so they even have a clue how to read our records. Our history is in a language that people are, it's going to look like hieroglyphics to people soon.
Oh, that's scary.
I know. My daughter knows. Yeah. She's 15. She knows cursive. I made sure of it.
Okay. My grandchildren are not going to like me. No, that's okay.
Make it fun. Figure out how to make it fun.
Yeah. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
So I am on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube to an extent, but my company is Anders Genealogical Services, which nobody can spell, but Micah Anders is my name, M-I-C-A, Anders, A-N-D-E-R-S, and I'm pretty much the only one, so you type that in and I pop up pretty fast.
There you go. I was checking out your social. And on Instagram, you had a quick video about finding someone with your fairly unique name.
I did, a high schooler.
Can I tell you a funny story? I think it's funny. So my name is Agnes Knowles. People look at me funny when I say Knowles. So I often say, oh, like Beyonce. And I sometimes add, like my cousin, Beyonce. And they look at me because Beyonce and I are slightly different colors. And they go, yeah, right. And I go, no, really. And they go, like, they give me this face. And I go, Agnes? I said, who's Beyonce's grandma? Agnes. It's Agnes. And they look at me. And I said, seriously, I actually had one girl begging me if my cousin Beyonce came to visit me at some point in time when I bring her in. I must admit, I didn't tell her the truth.
No.
I'm sure she had a great story. So that seeing yours on there reminded me of how often poor Beyonce is named my cousin or my second cousin. Occasionally, she'll be my niece. I don't know.
Yeah, but same name.
There you go. And I mean, the Agnes even. Name. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So. Yeah, names are funny. I love it.
Yeah. Can I ask you a personal question? That was what I go digging for, is because I like to ask a personal question. You shared a couple of your secrets. I mean, this whole Middle European thing. But is there anything else about your own background that you went like, holy crow or holy crap or something?
I think the other thing that's been really...
That you can share.
I don't even know. Yeah, no, absolutely. So my mom always told me that my dad, he's passed, my dad had told her that he didn't think his dad was his dad. And I kind of asked, he didn't really ever say anything about it. He just said, just focus on my mom's family. That's kind of how he'd word it. Just focus on my mom's family. So I did. DNA proved that to be true. His dad is not his dad. But, and this is like the most frustrating thing about me being a professional genealogist, everybody always asks, how far have you gotten in your own family? Well, I still have not figured out who my dad's dad is. I have not figured it out. DNA has not helped me figure it out. That's my big secret, is I've gotten all these people's family secrets solved and I've moved their family histories back and I still don't even know who my grandpa is.
Oh, that's funny. There is an
Yeah.
expression that the cobbler's kids go shoeless, but it sounds like you've at least tried.
I have, but it's accurate because, if I put in the same number of hours on that I do on client projects, maybe I'll be further along. But, well, do I do the free project or do I do the project that puts food on the table, right? You got to
Yeah,
have to
exactly.
balance it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, you did spell your name, but your website link will be in the show notes, and all of your links are on your page at our website. Listeners, if you have thoughts on today's show, talk to us. I can't be the only one out there that just loves this whole concept of genealogy and tracing. And as you said, the mysteries. It's like, oh boy, some of the tracking I tried to do, like I was garbling my own brain. It was just like, blah. Anyways, leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. Maybe there was a question I didn't ask, Micah. Ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. Share this episode. So many people I talk with are interested in genealogy. Maybe it's our age and we can make it part of our legacy. Maybe you need to find out the truth behind a family myth, like me and my Spanish princess. Maybe you're just curious. If you're any of those things, probably your friends are too, or a family member that could help you do the digging. Three good reasons to share Micah's inspiration. If you enjoyed this conversation, click the follow button on your listening platform. It helps us grow. I'm also registered at Substack. Following there is free, and you'll get notified every time an episode is released. Micah Anders, thank you for being my guest today and being just telling us so much about your own research, but how to do it. And good luck with finding your grandpa.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. Have a great rest of week.
Thank you as well.